Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is May the 14th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
And Angela Meaden.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to say before we kick off that today is a special mini milestone. We have reached episode 10 of Consilience.
Yay!
Double digits! Woohoo!
That's something we should be proud of. I didn't think we'd make it this far.
No, really? Didn't. Why did we start then?
I always knew we would make it this far, but those haters who commented on our podcast, we said we weren't going to make it this far. Well, we've showed them.
Yes, we have.
Exactly. Now we're just aiming for 100.
Yeah.
Only 90 episodes to go.
Yeah. Let's teach Angela to appreciate history.
This week, I think it's going to be really easy. We are celebrating International Nurses Week. This is in honor of Florence Nightingale, who, if you don't know who she is, you are living under a rock. Florence Nightingale was a nurse in the Crimean War. That's where we first really meet her. And she figured out only after she was working on the war, actually, that bad sanitary conditions were causing the deaths of many of the soldiers. So she championed, you know, proper sanitation, clean water, all that kind of stuff for hospitals, which was unheard of before she did that. But I actually think that we should have an International Florence Nightingale Day instead of just Nurses Day. I think we should actually make her like the subject of our celebrations, because the Lady of the Lamp was one incredible woman. Not only was she a pioneer of all these modern nursing techniques that we use today, but she was also a gifted mathematician, and she pioneered the visual presentation of information and statistical graphics.
She invented the pie chart, didn't she?
She didn't invent it, but she was one of the first people to actually use it to present data in a proper way. She was elected the first female member of the Royal Statistical Society in 1859.
Quite a gal, that gal.
Every time we say that, Michael gets a bit more frustrated.
Oh, well. Well, she's stereotypically known as, you know, just the Lady of the Lamp, this kind, caring woman who took care of the sickly soldiers, because that's how she was presented in the British media at the time. But as Angela just mentioned, she made important contributions to the science of medicine. And a lot of these findings predated, or at least predated, the widespread acceptance of the germ theory of disease. So there was no underlying reason for people to suspect before the germ theory of disease, just the idea that invisible microscopic organisms cause disease, there was no underlying reason for people to suspect that something like sanitary conditions could be important. And she used statistics to discover that soldiers who were treated in cleaner facilities died less often.
I learned in a recent episode of QI that Florence Nightingale's hospital in Crimea during the Crimean War was one of the least successful hospitals during the war. In fact, they had the highest mortality rate of all, and it was out of guilt for her perceived failure to help the soldiers under her care that she, upon returning to England, dedicated her life to figuring out why they'd survive and how to improve it.
And she used science!
Yes.
Yes. And she, I mean, apart from being a great scientist, she was one of the first women who was actually allowed to stand up and present statistics to the men, because the men, you know, wouldn't take instruction from a woman, and she actually turned that around. So
fantastic pioneer.
Yep.
Yes, and it's also important, of course, to remember all the other nurses who help us day to day, and in particular, our faithful listener, Joe Benamu. Hi.
Hi, Joe.
All right, then, shall we move on to updates and that sort of thing?
Sure.
So for the last couple of weeks, we were going on about how we were going to attend the South African Telescope Exhibition, and we were very excited to go, but once we got there, we were somewhat disappointed.
Yes, indeed. When we got there, it was very exciting to see some of the exhibitors that had their stalls out and about in the museum. There were lots of fascinating homemade telescopes and beautiful homemade sundials and things like that, and all the local astronomy society clubs and that sort of thing were out to recruit members, and that was all very interesting. But when we ventured into the lecture hall where there were speakers giving astronomy-related talks, that was when our disappointment kind of set in.
Yeah, absolutely. Owen and myself and a friend of ours called Yaku, we decided to attend a lecture called What's New in the Universe by Case Raystake of the Astronomy Society of South Africa. He is apparently the education and public communication spokesman for the ASSA. So we went into the hall and everyone sat down, and I don't think there was 1 minute of that talk that was really good. He didn't cover anything that was really new. A lot of his material was very old.
The topic of his talk was, what's new in the universe?
Yes, and it wasn't. It was not new. And I must say, I was seriously disappointed in that whole talk. He was showing slides of pictures of Comet, what's a temple, where they smashed the little probe into it to watch the dust. I mean, that all happened like...
Impact. You know. But that specific image is new.
Okay, but, you know, we're not talking about new science here. We're talking about stuff that's pretty old. And then when he started taking questions, it got worse.
Yeah, it was quite disappointing. I stuck around then for two more talks after that. The meetings had had enough at that point, and then they left me and Yaku to it.
I think I had more fun. It was held at the Military History Museum. I had more fun looking at the military equipment than the astronomy stuff. So, anyway.
The second talk that I attended was much better, much higher quality. It was performed by Cobus Alkers, who works for SANSA, which is South Africa's new South African National Space Agency. So that's our equivalent of NASA. And his job is the Space Weather Officer, which I admit going in, I wasn't all that thrilled about. It didn't seem all that interesting a topic, but he just brought the subject alive. Essentially, he is the guy whose job it is to, when he detects a solar flare, he phones ESCOM, the local power utility, and tells them to switch their transformers off so that they don't overload. This is that guy. And he just had thrilling animations and visual aids showing us not only different kinds of solar activity, different kinds of solar flares, but also the impact that they have on ground-based infrastructure. And he also shared a really awesome anecdote about a solar flare detector that he built himself. He took a digital satellite TV decoder and reprogrammed it so that when it displays a particular kind of interference, he knows that there's a solar flare going on. So
that is cool.
Exactly. Even though he has access to all of NASA's satellites and various ground-based geomagnetic stations and that sort of thing, his little homemade solar flare detector gives him instant feedback before all that data arrives, so he knows to take action before all of that kind of stuff gets in. It was really an excellent talk. I really enjoyed that one. The third talk that I went to was even more disappointing than the What's New in the Universe one. It was titled Ask an Astronomer, and they had a panel of two astronomers, Case Raystack again, and Professor Marty Hoffman, and they took questions from the audience, and I was very disappointed in the quality of their responses. Now, in their defense, a little bit, a lot of the questions that they battled to answer related specifically to cosmology and astrophysics, and these two guys being astronomers and not theoretical physicists may have been a little out of their depth, but they didn't say at any point, okay, look, I'm not a cosmologist, but here's what I understand about the question. I mean, they fielded questions on topics like cosmic strings and white holes and trans-Uranian islands of stability and things like that, and they really didn't seem to know what they were talking about. I was really quite astonished that I knew the better answer to the question than the guys who were on stage.
Yeah, that is the impression I got as well in the What's New in the Universe talk, is that the guy on stage couldn't actually give a clearer understanding of the topic than I already had in my head or could find with 30 seconds on Google.
Right.
It was very uninspiring.
Indeed. I'm not really sure what to make of all this, but I think I was rather disappointed in general with the quality of the speakers, with the exception of Cobus Alkers. And I'm not sure if I'll be attending the talks at next year's Scopex. I'm not sure it's worth it.
The one thing that I really, really liked at Scopex this year was the meteorites. We have a crater here in South Africa called the Tswayeng Meteorite Crater. And we had some Department of Science and Technology guys with a table that they'd set up with some pictures. And they actually had samples of meteorites. And one of them was a solid iron meteor, which was really incredible. The thing was about the size of a brick, but it must have weighed 5 or 6 kilograms. And it was solid. And you could see the beautiful crystalline structure. That was the height of the day for me.
That was impressive.
We have a photo we post.
Yes, we'll post that in the show notes. All right. Well, shall we move on to the news?
Yeah, let's tackle the news.
Okay. Well, our first story for this week is talking about smallpox. Now, we've mentioned smallpox a few times in the last few episodes when we've been talking about vaccines. And now we're talking about the last remaining samples of smallpox and what should be done with them. Now, just to bring you guys back up to speed again, smallpox is an infection infectious disease in humans that's caused by the variola virus, the two different versions of the variola virus. And it's believed to have first emerged around 10,000 years ago, and the first solid evidence we have of it is in the mummified body of Pharaoh Ramesses V of Egypt, which is around 3,000 years old.
That is so cool.
That is awesome.
That is totally awesome.
I believe there was a plague that was one of the reasons why Athens lost the Peloponnesian War in the 5th century, 4th or 5th century. And I believe that was caused by smallpox as well. So it has had a big impact on the course of history as well as, you know, on the deaths of pharaohs.
Oh, yes, quite right. I saw a factoid about how just in the late 18th century, I think it was 5 monarchs in Europe were killed by smallpox.
Huh. Wow.
It was an enormous problem. In the 20th century, an estimated 500 million deaths. So that's 500 million people are estimated to have died from smallpox in the 20th century.
Now compare that to World War II, that was about 50 million people, right, including civilian deaths. So that's an order of magnitude.
Right. It was a huge problem.
Hmm. Thank goodness for vaccines.
Indeed. The good news is that in 1979, 1980, the World Health Organization, or its predecessor, declared that smallpox had been eradicated in the wild. And as far as we know, that's true. The only exception being a few samples in various pathology laboratories around the world. And it was decided that there would be a deadline by which all of those samples were to be destroyed. And that deadline was 1993. But here we are in 2011, and there are still samples left in laboratories.
Typical UN. Yeah. I think they've only just now decided to intervene in Rwanda.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, I'm being sarcastic. This is a reference to the inaction of the UN after the Rwandan genocide in 1994.
Indeed. And, the World Health Organization has their annual meeting this week, and on the agenda is the question of what should be done with the remaining samples. Of course, they're still advocating that these samples should be destroyed, but there's a controversy about the question because a lot of scientists are saying, no, hang on, we should be hanging on to these samples because we can, as long as they're in laboratories, they're safely contained and we can continue to study smallpox and learn what we can about it. Smallpox is an interesting disease because it's highly infectious. It's unique to humans, which is fairly uncommon. Hmm. No other species is capable of contracting smallpox. And it also presents symptoms very quickly, which is also unlike diseases like HIV, for example. So by studying smallpox and contrasting what we learn about it with those other diseases that are a problem today, we can learn more about those diseases, and which might lead us closer to cures for those things.
So I suppose the biggest fear would be a terrorist attack on a medical lab that has smallpox, and then because anyone born after 1980 would not have been inoculated against smallpox, or at least most people, I suppose. And then if the terrorists then release this pathogen into the wild again, you know, you'd have mass deaths. Mm. So it's a balancing act between, on the one hand, the clear scientific interest we have in this pathogen and the risks of keeping it. My gut sides with the science and saying, look, we should study this thing more. But perhaps there's a case for having it in only one lab, say, you know, destroy most of the samples and have one super duper highly secure lab surrounded by the best defenses imaginable kind of thing.
Right. Carl Zimmer from The Loom, who is a previous guest of ours, name dropping.
Our friend Carl,
he posted on his blog about exactly this question. And his point seems to be that because we already know how to beat smallpox, and compared to other diseases, it's a relatively easy disease to contain. As deadly as it might be, odds are even if it does manage to get out into the wild, it probably wouldn't spread very far. We'd be able to clamp down on a breakout fairly quickly. So the risk isn't as great as it might be for something like Ebola or polio.
You know, if we've eradicated it in the wild, why do we need to keep samples in the lab? One thing that was stated was that if there were another breakout, then we would at least have this in the lab that we could use. But surely after 30 years, whatever comes out of the wild is not going to be the same as what we have in the lab. There would have been some sort of evolution, some sort of change in the way the disease works. Why keep this stuff?
Well, I think the thought is that you do basic science with it. So, you know, the lessons we learned from smallpox might not be specifically applicable to SARS, but perhaps there is some fundamental mechanism of disease transmittability that we learn from studying smallpox, which then also applies to SARS because they might have homologous or common evolutionary features. So that's the thought. But I mean, I can see both sides of the debate here.
maybe I'm just being too cautious, but I think that if we keep it, there is a risk that it will break out, especially if you're doing science with it. Especially if you're using it, if you're handling it, moving it about, the risk is great. Why not just destroy it? Why open ourselves up to this potential disaster?
Well, the labs cleared to hold it are exceedingly safe. You know, they're negatively pressurized, so even if there's a major accident and a leak happens, the air flows inwards instead of outwards, and the people are tested, and they have all sorts of precautions in handling it. And, I mean, we've had it now for 30 years, and it's not broken out yet. So now, is there any reason to suspect that with even better technologies than we had in 1980, that it will escape?
I've been careful to qualify when I say that, as far as we know, it's extinct in the wild. But there is still a possibility that there might be in some places, like maybe the former Soviet Union, where medical records aren't very good, there's still an outside chance that there might be wild populations of smallpox still living out there. Hmm. And until we can be completely certain that those no longer exist, it might be a good idea to at least keep some of the vaccine on hand.
Yeah, I think we should probably leave it to a panel of experts rather than a bunch of amateurs like us.
Yeah.
But it's a fun thing to think about, and it will also, hopefully, this will be a problem we face with polio soon, if we manage to eradicate that in the wild.
Right, this is a good problem to have.
Yeah, sure. It's a much better problem to have than the problem we have with, say, HIV or malaria or SARS.
Yeah.
Quite right. All right, then, shall we move on to our next story?
Sure.
Yeah. Let's talk about some astronomy again.
Yay.
Astrology.
Astronomy.
What's the difference?
Oh, no.
Don't even go there.
Astrology, astronomy.
Michael, I will ban you from this podcast.
We'll cover that in a 101 for you, Mike. Don't worry.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I've probably been muted.
So, yesterday, Friday the 13th, we received... We received news that a PhotoPic Sky Survey was released by a man called Nick Reisinger. He's an American guy who spent a year taking photographs of the night sky and stitched all the photographs together and made the most incredibly beautiful picture I have ever seen of the night sky. It is stunning. I highly recommend you go and look for it. Let me give you a few stats. Nick produced this 5,000 megapixel photograph of the entire sky by stitching together 37,440 single exposures. So this was an enormous task. He had to use 6 air-cooled cameras to take these photos. He divided the sky into 624 equally spaced squares of 12 degrees on a side, and then used his 6 cameras to take 6 short, 6 medium, and 6 long exposures of each square with each camera.
Oh,
yeah, the amount of photography that went into this thing is just phenomenal.
And when you say it's a whole sky, it's both northern and southern hemisphere.
Correct. What he did is he used 2 locations to take the photographs. The one was in Western America, and the other was in the Western Cape of South Africa. That's how we are talking about it, because he got his entire southern hemisphere through our skies.
Awesome. Cool.
And the picture is superb. You can zoom in on it. You can get really, really close up. It's high definition. It's beautiful.
Well, 5,000 megapixel, that's quite a download.
That's huge.
I thought we'd kill our cap.
Yeah.
Well, I have something to tell you.
Uh-huh.
I think it's safe to say that any minute now, somebody will have rendered this into Google Sky and will be able to zoom and pan using Google Earth. That'll be fun.
Well, he has built in some rather interesting functionality. If you go to the website, it is www.skysurvey.org, and he has built in sort of interactive star maps. So you can check out the constellations and things that he's like drawn in between the stars, which really would help me, because if you tell me that's a teapot, I tell you, no, you are lying. It's 6 stars. So
that's awesome. So he's built like something like Stellarium, which is a kind of a planisphere program for your PC, but he's built that using his photograph instead of the mathematically rendered stars. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And in his spare time. Wow. Well done.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So Nick, you rock, dude.
Nick is a hero.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Michael's going to tell us about a Titan boat.
A really, really big boat?
No.
Watch out for icebergs.
Oh, God. Luckily, there are no icebergs on Titan, as far as I know. Well, maybe. Methane icebergs. So, there's a proposed NASA mission that will land a boat on Saturn's moon Titan. Titan is one of the most interesting places in our solar system. In 2006, it was discovered that Titan has lakes of liquid methane,
wow,
as well as rivers and rain. And so it has a whole methane-based weather system. And all this was discovered with the Cassini mission, which is still ongoing, and they've produced absolutely fantastic photographs and fantastic science. And long may that mission continue. Now, if selected, the Titan Mare Explorer will launch in 2016, arrive in Titan in 2023, and then parachute into Lake Ligeia Mare, a 500-kilometer diameter lake in Titan's northern hemisphere. So, it's a substantial lake. Luckily, it's about 100,000 square kilometers. So, you know, their aiming doesn't have to be precise.
It still has to be pretty accurate.
The proposed boat will carry a couple of cool instruments, including a mass spectrometer to characterize the lake's chemistry, a sonar to investigate the lake's physical characteristics, and various cameras.
It will not have a scratch and sniff attachment.
Damn.
And it will be powered in an interesting way. There's a still in development system called Advanced Stirling Radioisotope Generator that will replace the current generation of electricity production technologies using isotopes. So it just takes radioactive substances, which then decay, producing waste heat, and they then generate electricity from that. So it'll use fairly advanced technology.
So it's nuclear, in other words.
Yeah.
Nuclear.
It's nuclear, yeah. And with its mass spectrometer, if there's life on Titan, which is a possibility, it's an outside possibility, probably quite unlikely. It's very, very cold there, so chemistry proceeds very slowly. But there could be life. And if there is life, there's at least a possibility that the Titan Mare Explorer will detect it. I should clarify that the mission has not been funded yet. It's currently competing against two other missions for funding as part of the Discovery program that NASA has. So it is competing against the Geophysical Monitoring Station mission to Mars, which will be a lander that will study the planet's deep interior, and the Comet Hopper mission that will study the evolution of a comet as it approaches the sun by landing on it repeatedly. I'm not sure why it doesn't just stay there, but there are not very many details.
Oh, man. Boring.
Why do we have to compete? Those both sound awesome.
No, they sound lame. Take us to Titan.
Okay, well, the Martian Geophysical Monitoring Station sounds a bit lame.
Yeah, but we've landed on Mars.
But comet hopping? That sounds freaking cool.
We've flown things at comets already. Take us to Titan. Come on.
Oh, but we've already dropped Huygens down there.
Can we have all three?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to make a point about that just now. So the Discovery program is a NASA program that is a series of tightly focused and relatively cheap missions. And some really awesome results and missions have been produced already, including the Mars Pathfinder, which you'll remember from 1997 when it launched Sojourner, the first Mars rover, and also the Kepler Exoplanet Finder that we've talked about a couple of times, as well as the Messenger orbiter around Mercury, which Angela discussed, I think, in episode one or two.
So these guys, these are the superheroes of NASA. These are the guys who are arguably the most scientifically successful program at NASA at the moment.
Sure, and they're cheap missions. They're $500 million, so capped at around about $500 million.
That's pocket change.
Which is nothing compared to, you know, something as big and wasteful and pathetic as the International Space Station, in my opinion.
Or Gravity Probe B, for that matter, which cost $750 million.
I have here in my notes, Q rant about space station, because $100 billion? Come on! We can have all three of these missions and several other missions
and Big Macs for everybody.
Yay, Big Macs.
Anyway, in my opinion, this beautifully illustrates the fact that we have to choose between these three missions. Well, I mean NASA. I'll leave the actual choice to them, obviously, because we're not experts, but whatever.
If we have to.
The Mars one does sound rather boring because it's sort of basic geology, and it's like, But either the Comet one or the Titan one, but the possibility of finding life for $500 million, fund all three of them, damn it. Stop astronauts. Down with with astronauts.
For $100 billion, we could have three. We could have each of these things on every planet in the solar system and Pluto.
Yeah, and interesting body. Anyway, whatever. Down with manned space flight.
Whoa, that's getting a bit far there.
Okay, sorry. Oh. That was sexist. Down with people in space. It makes no sense to send people to space. I know it inspires people on all that bollocks, but people just don't work in space at all. That's why you need robots. Send robots, not people. The end. Anyway, moving on to HIV.
We have some very, very exciting news about HIV this week.
Yay!
There is a study which was started in April of 2005. It is called HPTN052, very creatively named. And the study is headed by Myron Cohen, MD, who has discovered that by treating people who are HIV positive with antiretrovirals really, really early in the infection, you can actually cut HIV infectiousness by 96%.
Holy crap.
Yeah, 96%. We could actually see the eradication of this scourge. So, let me give you the details.
Please.
These guys recruited 1,763 couples who were all at least 18 years of age into the study. Every single couple had to have at least one member who was HIV positive. Okay. And they conducted the study at 13 sites in Botswana, Brazil, India, Kenya, Malawi, South Africa, Thailand, and the United States, and Zimbabwe. So it's cross-cultural, third world countries and first world countries. So they've got a pretty good cross-section of, you know, where HIV is prevalent. At the time of enrollment, the HIV-infected partners had CD4 plus T cell levels between 350 and 500 cells per cubic millimeter of blood. I'll explain what the CD4 cell is in a minute. So that was within 60 days of entering the study. The HIV uninfected partners had tested negative for the virus within 14 days of entering the study. So we know that these are people who are relatively healthy. The ones who were HIV positive were still healthy. They weren't suffering bad effects of the disease. And the people who were negative were definitely negative. So your CD4 plus T cell count is just a way to measure your immune system. The more the disease progresses, the lower your T cell count becomes. And we kind of know from that how to treat someone who has HIV. In South Africa, for instance, antiretrovirals are only prescribed to HIV positive people with T cell levels below 350. And this is a relatively new regulation. Until quite recently, the number was much lower. It had to be about 180, I think, which is really, really low to start treating the disease.
No, it's a bit too late.
Yeah, but by that time, you already have full-blown AIDS, I believe.
Yeah.
Because AIDS is defined by the number of CD4 T cells per microliter of blood.
So the investigators randomly assigned the couples to one of two study groups. In the first group, the HIV-infected partner immediately began taking the antiretroviral combination that the study was using. In the second group, which has been dubbed the deferred group, the HIV-infected partners only started to receive antiretrovirals once their CD4 counts fell below 250 or they had some sort of AIDS-related event, such as contracting pneumonia. Throughout the study, both groups received really comprehensive AIDS safety counseling. So they were counseled on safe sex practices. They were given free condoms. They got treatment for any sexually transmitted diseases, which they may pick up during the time. They were regularly tested for HIV if they had come into the study as negative. So they were looked after as best you can look after somebody. These guys took a lot of precautions to make sure that the participants in the study were being as responsible as possible, considering the nature of the disease.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an ethical requirement. You couldn't do the study without intervening somehow. That would be deeply unethical.
Yeah. So this month we had a review of the study, and during the review they found 39 cases of HIV infection amongst the previously uninfected partners. So there were 39 new cases of HIV. Of those, 28 infections were linked. So it was the same kind of AIDS as the partner had. All right. So there were 11 that are not linked. So they contracted the AIDS elsewhere, outside of the relationship.
Because there are different strains of HIV, right?
Correct.
Not all HIV is the same.
Correct. So here's the really interesting part. This is where the numbers kick in. Of those 28 linked infections, only one was from the group that received early treatment.
Wow.
One. So that is how you get a 96% reduction of infectiousness of HIV if you start antiretroviral treatment immediately.
That's very impressive.
I mean, it's a bit of a problem that this study or this review relies on such small numbers, but it's still quite significant. It's got a big difference. Was this study published in a peer-reviewed journal, or was this...
As far as I know, the study hasn't been published yet. They've just now, on these results of this review, they have terminated the study. They say, right, we know now what's happening, and we're not going to put these people at any more risk. So they are
pulling out. So a similar thing has happened in previous HIV studies. For example, studies of circumcision, where two groups of men were taken randomly, assigned to a circumcision group and to a non-circumcision group. And a preliminary analysis of data showed circumcision was so effective that the researchers thought it would be unethical to deny that treatment to the control group. So they terminated the study and gave everybody who wanted it the circumcision operation.
Yes, that's what they've done. So, everyone who wants it gets antiretrovirals.
Okay, so this suggests there's a needed policy change that South Africa and presumably other places need to give people the antiretroviral medications earlier, and then that prevents the transmission of the disease, which makes perfect sense because, of course, the antiretrovirals reduces the viral load in your bodily fluids, and as a result, the probability of transmitting it will go down. It's already fairly low. Even if you have sex with a HIV-positive person, you're not guaranteed to get it. I think for heterosexual sex, it's about 1 in 1,000. So it's fairly low already, but this is a way possibly to stop the disease from spreading, giving people antiretrovirals.
The problem, of course, is money. It's expensive to put every single HIV-positive person on antiretrovirals the minute they become infected, which is pretty much what you have to do. So I think that's going to be the limiting factor. We just have to ask ourselves, you know, how important is it to us that we eradicate this disease or do as much as we can to prevent transmission?
Just so we're clear, we're not talking about a new antiretroviral drug here. We're talking about a new treatment regimen, a new way of administering existing drugs.
Yes.
Sure. Now, it does raise some other ethical questions as well, because have they demonstrated that the people themselves who are HIV positive and receiving the antiretrovirals earlier, are they themselves benefiting?
Yes, they are benefiting. One of the things that this report actually states that people who were on this early treatment regime, they had far fewer incidents of AIDS-related illnesses such as pneumonia and, you know, these opportunistic things that set in. So this comes from the National Institute of Health in the United States. National Institutes of Health.
That's a very exciting development. This treatment holds up once it's administered to the general population. We could be looking at something analogous to a herd immunity situation where HIV could be gone in a generation.
That would be fantastic.
Very exciting.
Okay, so HIV to bees.
That's right, yes. In other news, cell phones kill bees.
No!
No, they don't.
I like blaming cell phones for things.
Yeah, you and just about everybody else. This is a personal bugbear of mine, is people blaming cell phones for everything.
What, are you paid by Nokia here?
No, but big phone?
Big telephony? You work for big telephony, don't you?
No, but I wish I did. And I will gladly accept any donations of phones. All right. So, Daniel Favre of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology has released a study in which he tests the hypothesis that electromagnetic signals released by cell phones have a deleterious impact on honeybees. Have a negative effect on honeybees.
Deleterious is a perfectly acceptable word.
It's a very good word, but, you know, it's a bit long.
The honeybees, to our South African listeners, these aren't the bees that we're used to. These are the pussy little bees that live... that live in Europe and North America. That our African bees are a lot more hardcore than them.
Yeah, I've seen many Discovery Channel documentaries dramatizing the African bees invade and
killer bees.
African killer bees.
They're just bees. Come on.
Wusses. All right, so there's been an ongoing problem when it comes to bees called colony collapse disorder, where entire hives of bees just go empty overnight, and the bee population has taken a major knock, and so has industry and agriculture that relies on bees to make their profits. They've been suffering badly, and it's an ongoing mystery as to what's causing this colony collapse disorder. And now Daniel Favre has put forward a hypothesis that it might be cell phones that are causing this colony collapse disorder. which is an interesting hypothesis, interesting in scare quotes.
So why does he think that cell phones are causing this collapse?
Well, this is the thing. You see, now cell phones work on the microwave part of the electromagnetic spectrum, right? So it works in a similar part of the EM spectrum to your microwave oven at home. That's why it's called microwave. But it emits a very small amount of energy, so considerably less than standing in the sun for a few minutes. It's not really all that plausible, but he suggests that maybe something in this radiation is affecting the bees somehow and is causing them to collapse.
And cell phones don't, or cell phones, or mobile phones don't emit ionizing radiation.
No, indeed.
Which is the dangerous bit of radiation. So as Owen said, it is rather implausible.
Right. I don't think he's actively suggesting that the cell phones are killing the bees or giving them cancer or anything like that, like the usual cell phone cranks claim. He's suggesting that it's impacting their behavior negatively.
Oh, so it might confuse them in some way. Okay, I can sort of see that.
That's sort of what he's suggesting. So it's a little implausible. There isn't really a clear mechanism there, but he's suggesting that this might be the case. And then he put that to the test. And he did that by taking some beehives and putting some active cell phones near to some of the beehives. And then he used some very sensitive microphones to keep track of the bees' buzzing sounds. And he also at the same time kept track of the queen bee's egg laying. Now, all of that sounds, you know, interesting. It sounds like he might be onto something. And he found a definite correlation between the hives that had cell phones next to them definitely fared worse than the ones that didn't have cell phones next to them. Okay, so that sounds interesting, except when you look at his sample size. The total number of hives that he used for the experiment was five.
Five.
And the total number of those hives that were exposed to cell phones at any one time is two. Yeah. So here what we're looking at is a problem with the experimental design in that the sample size is unbelievably low. When you've got such a small sample size, that the way it's virtually impossible to distinguish your results from chance. For all he knows, the two hives that saw an effect spent more of the day in the sun, so they were too warm and the bees were uncomfortable, and that's why they didn't perform as well. When you've got such a small sample size, you can't rule out enough extraneous factors to really get to the effect that you're looking for.
And do we have dead bees on the ground, or are bees just sort of moving?
They don't seem to be performing as well, right? So they're not collecting as much honey, and the queen isn't laying as many eggs, so that the hives the two hives with the cell phone exposure tended not to do as well as the other three hives. Okay. That seems to be the extent of the effect. But of course, that hasn't stopped the news media from picking up on the story and proclaiming that bees everywhere are being destroyed by cell phone radiation.
Of course.
And it doesn't stop wild speculation of people saying that, you know, there's a direct correlation between the rise of colony collapse disorder and the increase of cell phone use around the world.
Because of course, it fits into a very lazy and easy narrative that journalists can exploit, that, you know, the dangers of modern society. So
right,
exactly. I can understand why someone on Deadline might gobble this up. But hey, maybe it turns out that this guys onto something. It was published in a proper scientific journal, it looks like. For all we know, this might be true.
Yeah, so at best, this is something interesting that requires more research. I mean, we can't derive any meaningful conclusions based on the study. The just sample size is just too small. It's not useful to us at all.
Yeah.
The most we can get out of this is pointing out a direction where more research could be done in the future.
And we also need to know the state of the colonies before the cell phones were introduced. We need to know how much cell phone radiation they're exposed to on a day-to-day basis. You know, I mean, all these kinds of things need to be taken into account. Can't just choose five random beehives and put phones next to two of them and think that you're going to have anything. And also, if I'm not mistaken, cell phones only actually emit this radiation when they're being phoned.
Right, that was part of his experimental design, was he made sure that they were active all the time, so he was constantly calling and recalling the cell phones. Other than the sample size, the study methodology seems to be pretty good as far as I can tell. I mean, if I was wanting to test this is probably the way I would go about doing it. I would just do it with more than five hives.
Yeah, but I mean, one shouldn't underestimate how big of a problem colony collapse disorder is. I mean, this is something of a separate point, but basically human beings will die without bees. Billions of people will die without bees, because without bees, there is no fertilization of our agricultural crops, and without our agricultural crops, we all starve to death, basically.
We'll have to live off strawberries.
Sure, and maybe watermelons and bananas don't need to be fertilized. Yeah. So maybe we can eat bananas, but billions of people will die. So it's a dire problem, and hey, the more research research that gets done on it, the better. And if it turns out to be cell phones, then we're going to have to do something drastic about that. Maybe have cell phone-free zones where bees can roam. But that's way too early to tell.
So, from billions of people dying from bees disappearing to billions of people dying during the rapture.
Again.
Yay. Yes. As we sit here, we are a mere 7 days from the coming, the second coming of Christ.
Who?
So, isn't he the guy who invented Christmas?
I think he is, yes.
Didn't he have a bunny that lays eggs every time he dies?
About that, and flying reindeer, is that the guy?
That's no. the guy.
Oh, he has right. a red uniform.
He's yes. the one who tattles on you if you're naughty.
And he lives next door to Superman?
Yes.
Yeah, right, okay.
So, before we get lynched, there's a guy in the United States called Harold Camping, who has become rather notorious. He's involved in something called Family Radio, which I don't really have much exposure to. As far as I can see, there's a website with a lot of really crackpot ideas. So, Harold Camping has spent 5 decades studying the Bible intensely, and he has decided that the 21st of May, 2011 is the day that the rapture will happen.
But that's next Saturday.
Yeah, so we better record a lot of podcasts if we want to get to 100.
No, hang on. Now, before we carry on, what is the rapture exactly?
So, the rapture is basically when all of the very good little people who believe in God are going to be rescued and taken up into heaven, and all of us heathens and Satanists and atheists are going to be left on earth to suffer for 6 months.
So it's only the interesting people are left behind. Yes. That's what you're saying.
Okay. So this is when Jesus comes along in his spaceship and beams up all the goody two shoes.
That's correct. Nice. Yes. Yes.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, actually.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it too, because one of the predictions of the Bible is that it is easier for a camel to fit through the eye of a needle than it is for a wealthy man to get into heaven. So, between now and next week, Saturday, everyone who wants to go to heaven is going to have to give away all this stuff.
Yes. Now we're talking.
I recommend charity.
Yes.
Or us.
Yeah, I'll take it.
I'm a charity case.
I could totally use some money. Yeah. I think we need to go find some people who are going to get beamed up and have a chat with them. Any of our listeners, if you're likely to get beamed up, please drop us an email at consiliencecast@gmail.com.
We take donations.
And we promise, in exchange for taking all your stuff, we promise to take care of your pets.
Yes, we yes, will indeed. Look after all your doggies and kitties.
Quite right. If you go to eternal-earthbound-pets.com, you'll see that there's a service that has been set up for exactly that purpose.
Okay, so enough fun and games, guys. In order for you to accept that the 21st of May 2011 is going to be the date of the rapture, you have to simultaneously accept that the entire earth was created on a day in 11,013 BC.
At around noon. It was a warmish day. I think it was a Wednesday.
Well, that's easy enough to accept.
Yes.
Oh, wait, except for the whole Big Bang and beginning
and
of the universe.
All of the
13.7
science,
billion years.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty about that stuff. Yeah, otherwise, so it would be really easy.
You basically have to deny the entire body of science, which tells us through very well-established facts of geology and carbon dating that the Earth is actually older than 13,000 years old. Why is the second coming of Christ so important?
I don't know.
Well, because it is a fundamental part of the doctrine of the entire Christian religion. This whole body of faith is built up on the idea that Christ dies and comes back to life a second time. After the second time, so a third time.
So he'll be like a double zombie then?
Yes, he'll be a double zombie.
But this is not the first time, as you may expect, that someone has predicted the end of the world. James Randi, I believe it is, has a very long list, and I see Angela has open here a Wikipedia article called Unfulfilled Religious Prophecies.
Because Angela kicks ass. So let's have a look at some of the dates, shall we?
Let's do it.
1757.
1829.
1844. 1974, 1891, 1914, 1917, 1939, 1975, 1981, 1982, 1989, 1995, 1982, 1999, 1992, 1999, 2007, 2008, 1999 until 2009, 1994 to 2011, 2012, 2022, 2025, 2057. I mean, this is ridiculous. So, if it hasn't happened on the 50 times you guys have already predicted it, what makes you think it's going to happen this time?
The oldest one I've been able to find comes from RaptureReady.com, where they claim that in 53 AD, this is before half of the New Testament had even been written.
Yes, because it was meant to happen, the original second coming of Christ was meant to happen within one generation of Christ's death.
Right, exactly. That there are texts in the New Testament that specifically say that, which have since been doctored to change the way that sounds. And, of course, creative reinterpretation of those texts also.
And staring at the Bible for 50 years.
Yeah, that'll do it
too. Maybe you should read another book, Harold.
Well, and Harold Camping has predicted the end of the world before. He said the rapture would occur in September 1994. Now, unless I was really not paying attention back then, this hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I didn't notice anybody beaming up back then.
Right.
Now, as far as I'm aware, there's still some pretty hectic Christians around.
Quite right. But Kemping's in good company, you know, because a particular scientist also had tried his hand at predicting the date of the rapture. Exactly. Isaac Newton predicted that it would happen in 2060. We've got plenty of time until then, though.
Yeah, okay. Now, I'm okay.
Now, frankly, if I have to choose between the predictions of Isaac Newton and Harold Camping, I'm going to go with Isaac Newton every time.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry.
Especially because it gives us another 50 years to fornicate.
You can't see me face palming.
This is Dr. Stephen Novella from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, but right now you're listening to Consilience.
All right, then let's move on to our feature, and we're going to be carrying on with our series on big history. This week we'll be looking at abiogenesis. Mike, what is abiogenesis?
It is the origin of life from non-life. So A is without or none. Bio is life, and genesis is creation. So it's the creation of life from non-life. So far in our big history segments, we have seen how the universe itself began and then how galaxies and solar systems were formed. So in the case of the Earth, we're roughly 4 billion years ago now when life first arose. It's not known exactly when life first came to be on Earth. There are some suggestions that it happened very, very soon after the creation of the planet Earth, about 4.5 billion years ago. And there are suggestions that it's a bit later, about 3.5 billion years ago.
So a bit longer ago than 11,000 years.
Just a touch.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit, yes.
All right.
So we know that at some point in Earth's history, there was no life at all. And then at some point, life arose. And we need some sort of explanation for how this came to be. And abiogenesis remains one of the most important open scientific questions. And although we do know from various experiments, like the Miliura experiment that Angela discussed in episode 3, that organic compounds can be created from very simple, very basic chemical processes that go on all the time. And these include the building blocks of life, such as amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Now, we do not, however, understand abiogenesis or how it happened yet. There are, however, multiple theories, the most prominent of which, and quite possibly the most likely of which, is the RNA world hypothesis. So currently, all life relies on three large organic molecules. These are RNA, DNA, and proteins. We're all familiar with DNA. RNA is very similar to DNA, but its function is to essentially very roughly get instructions from the DNA and then go build proteins. So it's like a messenger molecule in modern day cells. And then in the ribosome, proteins get created, and these proteins then serve various functions. The idea of the RNA world hypothesis is that what emerged first was a replicator, and all a replicator is just something that has instructions for its own creation.
Right, it's not a food station from Star Trek or one of those robotic aliens from Stargate.
And the nice thing about focusing on replicators instead of life itself is because you, of course, run into a bit of a definitional problem when it comes to life, because there's no agreed upon definition of what life actually is. There's an ongoing debate, for example, about whether viruses are life.
As far as I understood it, in order to be classified as being alive, you had to be able to replicate and you had to be able to metabolize.
Sure, that's probably one of the most basic definitions of life, but there are others.
Well, I'm pretty basics.
there are certain other things that might qualify there. Crystals, for example, could qualify as life under that definition. So could fire, perhaps. It's kind of murky waters.
Yeah, sure. It's hard to come up with a list of necessary and sufficient conditions, as it is for anything. I'm yet to meet anyone who can give me a definition of chair, for example. But moving on, if you focus on replicators, so it's just a molecule that can create a copy of itself. It need not be a perfect copy. In fact, it's quite a good thing if it's not a perfect copy. As soon as you have a replicator, or at least a replicator that makes imperfect copies, you have evolution. And evolution, of course, is the explanation for life. We must distinguish, as creationists don't, between the problem of abiogenesis and evolution. These are two separate questions. The one does not depend on the other. So you can accept all the findings of the modern science of biology that evolution happens, that's the explanation for the existence of complex contrivance in organisms, without fully understanding how abiogenesis occurs. So the idea of the RNA world hypothesis is that an RNA molecule arose by some chemical process, a big chunk of which would have involved chance. And because an RNA has interesting properties, it could have served as the very first important living system that could both replicate and metabolize. So in modern biological systems, DNA stores information, proteins are involved in metabolism and catalysis, and RNA sort of does a little bit of both, and it serves as a bit of a messenger, but it's not as fundamental as the other two. But the interesting thing about RNA and the reason for the popularity of the RNA world hypothesis is that RNA can do both of these functions. It combines the function of catalysis, i.e. the ability to make certain chemical reactions happen a lot faster and a lot more efficiently, which would be important for metabolism, and the ability to store information. So RNA is really, it combines the abilities of proteins and DNA in a single molecule. Now, several people, including Dawkins, have pointed out that for abiogenesis to work, you need not come up with a process that is at all likely. So in your lifetime, if you play the lotto every day for the rest of your life, you will in all probability not win it, right? But now imagine you played the lotto every day for the next 10 million years. In all probability, you're going to win it at least once. So even if the emergence of a replicator or an RNA-like molecule was exceedingly unlikely, on the order of 1 in 1 million, 1 in 100 million, there was likely more than enough time in the history of life for the very unlikely series or very unlikely confluence of events to come together in just the right way, that just the right constituents were just in the right place at the right time, at the right concentrations, with the right sources of energy that combine to create the very first replicator. And the idea is that all life is descended from a single universal common ancestor. So this only need have happened once.
There's a common creationist argument. Well, I don't know how common it is anymore, but I've seen it at least a few times, where as a hand-waving dismissal of evolution, they use the word evolution incorrectly. What they really mean in this context is abiogenesis. They will point out that the jar of peanut butter on their pantry shelf, when they open it, they don't find life inside. Therefore, abiogenesis is not real. It couldn't possibly have happened. But as Mike points out, it doesn't have to happen every time. It only needed to happen just the once.
That's just classic. I remember seeing that video. It was a follow-up to the banana and atheist's nightmare.
Right.
If you remember that from...
Yes, because a banana is just the right size and shape to fit into your hand. And it's conveniently peelable. Therefore, God made them for humans to eat.
There's another kind of peel that's also conveniently shaped for that, but
oh, sorry, the Afrikaans joke.
Sorry, that's a South Africanism. I won't explain
that. You don't want to know. But of course, some dumbass creationist to take peanut butter off his shelf might have new life in there, but would probably not notice it. Do they have the right equipment to do DNA analysis?
No.
No. So anyway, that's just deeply idiotic. But the other point, of course, is that bacteria and microscopic organisms are everywhere. So even if a rival type of life was to arise, it could just be gobbled up by a highly successful modern bacterium. So even if it happens in a your jar of peanut butter, it might just be gobbled up by existing bacteria that obviously do live in the peanut butter already.
Yeah, but you're being a little bit too simple-minded here, Michael. Don't you know that life has to be, they're probably expecting a frog.
Or a crocodile.
Something significant that could prove.
We can't actually rule out with any certainty that abiogenesis hasn't happened more than once.
Sure.
There may well be a whole, what they call a shadow biome, a whole separate kind of life that existing under our noses, and we just aren't aware of it because we just haven't sampled enough of life on Earth to know with any degree of certainty that isn't the case.
I heard a statistic that it's anywhere between 1 and 10% of the existing species on Earth currently that we actually know anything about.
Right.
And there's a new story that we decided not to cover this week, which was an entire new and very abundant branch of the fungi has been discovered in a lake like 100 meters from, the researchers' offices or dam.
But and it's not only in that one pond, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
They found it in your garden soil under the Arctic ice caps. This stuff is everywhere. And until recently, we didn't even know it existed.
Right.
And it's a whole new branch of the tree of life. It's fantastic.
So it could be that there's a shadow biome, but we just don't know about it. But probably the simplest explanation is that life arose once.
The RNA world hypothesis is not the only theory. Another possible explanation for how life arrived on Earth is panspermia, which is the hypothesis that it traveled here on a meteorite from another planet or another solar system entirely.
Or could have been seeded here by intelligent aliens.
Sure.
Yeah. Of course, this doesn't really deal with the questions behind abiogenesis because you still have to answer how that life arose on whichever comet or alien spaceship it came here from. So that doesn't really handle the problem.
Abiogenesis had to happen somewhere along the line. Even if it didn't happen on Earth, it happened somewhere.
Yes.
Sure. There are a number of other hypotheses about how abiogenesis occurred, the iron sulfur world theory, and so on, but we need not go into very many details. We'll provide some links in the show notes. Suffice it to say, it's still an open scientific question, and one interesting approach that is currently being pursued by Craig Venter and his group is they're taking a top-down instead of a bottom-up approach. So one way to go about trying to replicate the origin of life, and of course there's the famous saying by Richard Feynman that if you can't build something, you don't understand it. So the idea is that unless we can create life again, we don't really understand how it arose in the first place, which of course could be very difficult if it is exceedingly improbable, as I mentioned earlier. But the bottom-up approach is something akin to the Uri Miller experiments, where you take a bunch of chemicals, you plonk it into a flask, you provide some source of energy, just electricity currents, and then you hope against hope that life somehow arises. Of course, the Miller-Urey experiments never came close to creating life. They just created the building blocks of life. But a more advanced experiment could, in principle, recreate the origin of life in that way. We're not close to that yet. And that's the bottom-up approach. But the top-down approach is to attempt to build a minimal cell. And that's what Venter and his group are doing. And they have taken a cell and stripped out all the, extra evolutionary layers and tried to make a cell that has as simple a structure as possible. And they've actually made quite a bit of progress on this front already. And they've managed to, for example, take the DNA from one microorganism and have it boot up into the cellular structure of another. And the idea is if you keep stripping away the complex parts that were later additions in evolutionary history, you could come back to something that approximates the very first cells. It's a very similar idea to creating a dinosaur by taking a chicken and removing all the chickeny bits. and just leaving the dinosaur bits. But all these different hypotheses and all these different approaches have yet to be shown to be true or accurate. So it is really an open scientific question that rewards further investigation. And who knows, perhaps in our lifetimes, we will finally have the answer to this extremely interesting and exceedingly complicated problem.
I predict that the Large Hadron Collider will unlock the secret.
That's somehow unlikely.
The way the Large Hadron Collider will do that is because it will open up a temporal vortex, allowing us to travel back in time 2 or 3 billion years, and we can watch it happening for ourselves, or maybe make it happening by, you know, taking a leak against a rock.
Okay.
Because then it means we're all descendants of your pee, and I don't like that idea.
I hate to break it to you, but we're all descendants of someone's pee.
All right. Let's move on from pee to something a bit more exciting.
What can possibly be more exciting than pee?
Far back in the mists of ancient time, in the great and glorious days of the former Galactic Empire, life was wild, rich, and on the whole, tax-free. In those days, spirits were brave, the stakes were high, men were real men, women were real women, and small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri were real small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri. And all dared to brave unknown terrors, to do mighty deeds, to boldly split infinitives that no man had split before.
Right, that was an excerpt from the BBC radio series of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Why did we play it for you? Because this week, on the 11th of May, marked the 10th anniversary of the death of Douglas Adams. He was a British writer, and we would like to pay further tribute to Adams and his wonderful writing by remembering some superb quotes from his books. I'll go first. There is a theory which states that if ever anybody discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened.
Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemists, but that's just peanuts to space.
Let me do another one. This one is one of my favorites. Let us think the unthinkable. Let us do the undoable. Let us prepare to grapple with the ineffable itself and see if we may not eff it after all.
A common mistake that people make when trying to design something completely foolproof is to underestimate the ingenuity of complete fools.
We're remembering Douglas Adams not just because he was an awesome creative writer, but because he was an active skeptic, and he, through his writing, he has inspired and helped bring home some of the more important ideas that us skeptics hold dear.
He was most certainly a skeptic.
Absolutely. He befriended people like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Fry and other important dignitaries in our movement. He was very much one of us.
And his writings and the excerpt you heard was from the original radio series, which I very highly recommend. I think it's even better than the books.
I agree.
So if you haven't heard the original radio series yet, you're very uncool, like Angela. and I suggest you acquire it somehow and have a listen. Adams is renowned for his absolutely preposterously funny humor and for the ingenious ways in which he takes science and uses it to, you know, satirical effect.
That's probably one of my favorite things about Adams' books, is the way that he uses the science. It's, you know, it makes my mind boggle at some of the, like, the improbability drive, where he decides that instead of having to, you know, make an engine and travel through space, you just make a device that does the most improbable thing, and that might be traveling between universes, and that's what it does. It's fantastic. Okay, let me round out with one more quote. He was a dreamer, a thinker, a speculative philosopher, or as his wife would have it, an idiot. That one's for you, Michael.
Thank you, my darling.
So yes, Douglas Adams, we salute you.
And we miss Douglas Adams. Yes. I have often thought with just sadness about how he would have thrived in the Web 2.0 era.
Oh, absolutely. Can you imagine following Douglas Adams on Twitter?
I just had pangs thinking about how hard I would have laughed at, you know, his jokes and his podcasts and his blogs. And he has a fantastic essay from the 90s. I think 1999 or even earlier, about how to learn to love the internet and stop fearing it. And it's just extremely prescient about how the internet would develop and sort of poking fun at the time of, you know, people's fears about it and so on.
Right. He was a very technologically savvy sort of person. He was one of the, I think he was the second person in the UK to own an Apple computer, the first being Stephen Fry.
We won't hold that against him, though.
No. We don't like Apple anymore. But in those days, it was a big deal.
Sure. I'm saying it's Douglas Adams, the only other person I sort of miss as much, at least when it comes to the skeptical movement, it would be Carl Sagan, who died 1996, I believe it was. So, yeah, here's to Douglas Adams.
Indeed.
May the 42th be with you. I don't know what that was.
All right. Well, then let's move on to announcements. And we have a doozy for you guys this week.
So this week's announcement, we only have one. Myself and a couple of my sidekicks have created the Gauteng Skeptics, and along with it, a little website you can visit to see what we get up to. We hope to garner some kind of presence in the media, and it's going to have links and to all of our writing and updates and on when we're meeting and, you know, podcasts and cool stuff like that.
And exactly. So if you're a skeptic in the Gauteng area, we're hoping to provide a one-stop shop resource for you to find out what's happening near and around you. And of course, prominently displayed on the Gauteng Skeptics website will be a link to Consilience,
your
African Science podcast.
So you might even say that we, the Consilience podcast, we're the official podcast of the Gauteng Skeptics?
I think you could say that. You can most certainly say that. Although I defer to our benevolent dictator, Angela, to make the final decision on that point.
You're listening to Consilience, the official podcast of the Gauteng Skeptics.
That's better.
We would have had the third member of our team here today. James, we miss you. You should be here instead of working hard, but maybe you can join us next week.
Yes, we're hoping to have James Hoff, my fellow lackey, joining us in the podcast soon. So where can we find us on the internet? Angela, where can people find you other than on the Gauteng Skeptics website?
Anyone who would like to can read my blog at skepticdetective.wordpress.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I am at Angela Meaden.
Excellent. And Mike, where can our listeners find you?
My blog is Ionian Enchantment, and I am Michael Meaden on Twitter.
Fantastic.
I'm also the Skeptic Detective on Facebook.
Awesome.
For those of us who use it.
You're on Facebook?
People still use that? What?
Face what?
Face.
The Facebook?
Yeah, boys.
And you can find all of my stuff at owenswat.org. My Twitter and Google Buzz and all of that sort of thing is all there.
Cool. All right. Thanks, guys.
Great. That's all we have for you this week. Thanks to my co-hosts and to you, the listeners. Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to conciliencecast@gmail.com. The music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
Now remember, it's panspermia, not pantspermia.
You're worse than me.